Welcome to Star League Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run the SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, Hannah, join us for a talkcast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call us on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444 to follow the directions, and the call ID is 17702. Or you want to participate on the web, just go to the TalkShoe website, the www.talkshoe.com, and search for call ID 17702. And of course, we have the co-broadcast on the Twitch network. So go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. That's twitch.tv/SFUONCALL, and you will find us there. There's plenty of people in the chat room these days. Please join us there and enjoy. And of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I have also sfuoncall account there, so same spelling as the previous two. Also, of course, I have a personal account, Paul, which is Paul Franz, PaulFranz. There is no T in Franz. And don't ask. And of course, if you follow me, just remind that I'm passionate about my Oreos. I'm passionate about being Catholic, and I'm passionate about tech. So if you don't like any of the, if I hit a nerve on any one of those, hey, don't follow me. Obviously, you want to contact me, yeah, feel free. And of course, I have a tertiary account called Franz Games for announcing all that's happening in Starfleet Warlord and in SFB Online. And of course, this lovely talkcast gets turned to a podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from A to B this week, which is, dun, dun, dun. Two great things happened this week. Number one, SFB module R4J Shadow of the Eagle is now available on DriveThruRPG, Wargame Vault, and of course Warehouse 23, whichever one you like to use. I usually like using Warehouse 23. That's because I've been using it for the longest period of time and I like Steve Jackson games. And of course, number two, the counters came in. So, if you want the physical copy of Module R4J with the counters, you can get them in. And these are special counters. These are beautiful counters in that they're double-sided. So, in the case of R4J, the whole idea of that is that you're going to have possibly civil wars. Because there's going to be a lot, possibly more fighting. And so that on each side is a different color, which is, I think, is an awesome thing to have. Obviously, there's difficulty with printing two-sided, and which I voiced to Gary many weeks ago when he talked about the counters. Moving on to the SFB Online Tournament. Currently, there's only the Masters Tournament that's being played, and it's going quite well. It's small, and since they don't actually post the tree, it's very hard to know where the tournament lies. You know, who's currently finished round one, who's starting in round two, who's playing, who's completed their games, things like that. So I have a hard time actually keeping an up to date on that. When it comes to the library, actually, we do have some progress. The FedCom library actually got 5 new ships. So squadron-sized ships are up to 382, and the fleet-sized ships are up to 283. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it makes sense. One of the old Paul friends welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we've got Barry, we've got Gary, we've got me, of course. But I will be saying hello to my fellow hosts. Barry, how you doing, man?
Hey, doing wonderful, doing wonderful.
You're awake.
Down in Georgia. Well, not for long.
Understood.
Probably wake up tomorrow.
Yeah, I was wondering if you're actually going to make it or not. But
I've been on the road constantly lately, more so than most times.
Understood, but that means dollar bill coming in, you know. So that's a good thing about
that. There is that, yes.
Okay. And Gary, how you doing, Gary?
Happy launch of Life 4 JD.
Happy what?
Happy launch of
R4J. Yeah. Took me a moment to click. You said it so fast. Yeah.
Module R4J.
Yep, that just got released.
What is R4J?
Gary?
Yep, it just got released today. It's Shadow of the Eagle, and you can actually, since the counter sheets arrived early this week, so double hooray, you can actually order them as spare parts right now.
Yeah, it's Barry, it's an alternate history.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Chris.
It's basically it's actually a set of five alternate timelines, although the book only really goes into three of them, where the Romulans basically develop war power in the early and middle years. So the product has basically a bunch of W and Y and middle years era, and even some National Guard era ships, as well as additional modern versions. Like, for example, there's a what the War Eagle would like if it was had the King Eagle engines but didn't have the command, the flag bridge. So it's basically a, they call it the War Queen Eagle or something. I don't remember the term that they use. Queen War Eagle. So it's and there's like there's a whole bunch of stuff in the rule book about the various progressions and stuff, and how to account for XYZ technology type or whatever as things go on. And there's some very interesting little ideas that have been thrown in there as well.
Interesting.
Yep, and actually it's also available in electronic form in Warehouse 23, Drive-Thru RPG, and of course Wargame Vault. So if you're interested,
I've been using E23. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like using Warehouse 23 myself. That's where I bought everything. So it's like, let's keep going there. And of course, I like some of the games from Steve Jackson too. So.
Oh yeah. What's there not to like there?
Oh yeah, yeah. One of the ones I got to play was of how was that one tank?
Ogre.
Thank you.
Ogre's great.
Yeah, they had a version that they had on Kickstarter. Oh, it was like $150.
And I didn't find out about it until the Kickstarter was over. It's like
Yeah, well, it is what it is. I forgot the Kickstarter just had a sale on buying a lot of the old games. You know, bring back some of the older games, like the original Car Wars and things like that. You know.
Oh.
Because Lord knows, if you really think about it, some of the older games could definitely be new again because of people are looking for games with a less amount of rules. And that was one of those beautiful things early on in board gaming history, when you had these small little games.
Right.
Like Warp War, Car Wars, even Starfleet Battles was originally, you know, very small. Things like that were very much simplified in the number of rules that you actually had in there.
I know.
So, what was old is new again. Hey, why not?
An idea for it.
Yeah, it's good for electronic version of those games too, in my mind, because actually, what was it? I'm pretty sure Three Moves Ahead, the podcast. I was one of those podcasts to listen to, and that is one of the things that they really appreciate is for those, computer game designers who go through and actually write up a set of rules that they use to base the game off of and kind of have it so they can play the game without actually writing a single bit of code. Of course, we're talking about Three Moves Ahead is mainly a strategies game podcast. So they're not as much into the first-person shooters, Or, of course, then you have the horror games, which are kind of, they can be interesting. The only reason I even know about some of those games is just because my daughter watches playthroughs from Markiplier on YouTube. So, and Lord knows, every once in a while I get caught.
You suffer through them.
Yeah, well, kind of. They're actually, I love Markiplier when it comes to the way he does things. They're very fun. The only issue I have is when he plays a game that has a jump scare. Because invariably, I jump.
Oh.
And my daughter laughs her head off because she sees me just like, ah!
Got you again.
Yeah. It's like, Dad, come on. I knew that jump scare was coming. It's like, yeah, but I didn't expect it at all. That's all. Well, that's the point of a jump scare,
Right.
Like Five Nights at Freddy. Jeez, holy cow. But anywho, other than talking about R4J, is there any other topics that either one of you wanted to talk about?
I'm not going to be around too much longer because I have such an early wake up, so I'm not going to be a topic setter tonight.
Okay.
Sadly. Yeah. I just have such
Well, I would like to
Yeah. By all means.
Yeah, I'd just like to stick with R4J just a little bit longer, if that's okay.
By all means.
I don't want to be too spoilery because people should have time to read it for themselves and digest all the stuff that's in it. But a few quick, notes might be, initial notes might be useful.
Oh, just one quick thing. I want to respond to Iggy and say, yes, Iggy, that's why I thought they had done a Kickstarter, and thank you for confirming that Steve Jackson Game Tech did a Kickstarter for Car Wars and other games. So, move on. Continue on, Gary.
Okay, so now, as is the case with the War Eagle, which is basically pretty slow for a middle-year ship, the same is true for the W and Y era versions that are offered here. So, for example, the Warbird from the W era still only has 12 warp boxes, so it's slower because your average W era ship has 16 warp boxes, like for a cruiser, I should say. So yes, it still does have that Type R plasma though, but it's not able to you launch it as a seeking weapon until after Y-89 or Y-88 or something like that. But and then also the Y era ships, they have the Warbird has about 18 boxes, so it's not that far off the standard Warbird that you'd see in basic set. But and by comparison's sake, most Y era cruisers can fight at speed 24. I guess it's to try to basically stop you from going too crazy with those Type R torpedoes.
Right.
And now they do. I'm trying to think here. They do actually, as I say, go into a lot of detail in terms of which refits are added. Now, one actually thing that's worth noting as well is that in the original Module Y1, they introduced the concept of two predecessors of the cloaking device, the mask and the veil. And in the standard timeline, right, neither of those work with warp-powered ships. They only work if you have, like, a sublight ship.
Oh.
So in this, the R4J, the mask is the same. So none of the actual ships have a masking device because it won't work with their warp drive. Mm-hmm. But the bases have them. So, for example, there's an SSD for the early space dock and one for the early base station, and they have masking devices. So, but what they've done is that there's a variant of the veiling device, which is basically, it's only got some of the features of a cloak. So I think it's, I forget the mono, but basically there's a refit where you can install the veil from Y124 onwards. So that's later in the timeline than the historical veil. But this version of the veil does work with warp-powered ships. So you basically get a bit more of a dynamic with the earlier ships compared to the a little bit different compared to like what you see in other timelines. Mm-hmm. But and actually the cloak itself is pushed back, so it only appears in Y150.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And the cloak is superior to the veil, I take it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mask and veil have fewer fade-in and fade-out impulses, but they also have fewer distances that they cover. And there's like, I'm forgetting something really important, but the mask and veil don't do. But yeah, basically they're more primitive versions. And actually in the standard timeline, there's even certain years where they stop working. So for example, if you play a scenario after Y120, even if you have a masking device and you try to run it, nothing happens because the enemy sensors can penetrate it. And something similar with the veil, it stops being effective after Y150. But I don't think it's been clarified just yet if that's the same for this improved version of the veil. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, like, it's, bear in mind that the upload is the early bird version, they call it. So there's still time for people to read it, spot anything they might have a question about, and post on the DBS to see if they can, you know, get it errated in time for the actual print release.
Ah. That would definitely be.
And, one final reminder is, one final reminder is that the counters have the same ship in two different colors on the front and back. So if you want to play out Civil War scenarios, you can.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
That's definitely cool. And they did two sided counters.
Yeah, because remember we were saying before that they did them at the same time as a bunch of new F&E counters. And right, since the F&E counters are always double-sided, they were going to be doing the SFB ones double-sided, but initially they didn't really have anything planned. So the idea came up to do the Rebel Romulan colors on the back, on the opposite side, so that people can do Civil Wars more easily, which is appropriate because one of the products that is in this counter sheet run is F&E Civil Wars, which, guess what, comes with the Romulans. So they...
True. True. The and as we talked about, you know, those many weeks ago, I think it's been over a month now, about the issue with two-sided counters is, of course, matching them up, make sure that when they're printed on both sides of the cardboard, that they match up. So when you cut it, whether you're looking at the front or the back, that actually has the full counter image that's supposed to be on the counter.
It would be easier to do the
the word is that counters
on the client.
Oh, cool. What was that, Gary?
It should be easier to do the double-sided client counters on the client.
Oh yeah. Well, there's that'd be more of basically alternate counters would be in that case.
Yeah.
There. I was just going to say that the word is that from Steve Cole is that the new counters turned out perfectly, so everything's good to go.
Cool. I can't wait to see them. Well, actually,
cool.
couldn't you actually download them? Or did they not have e-versions?
No,
or was that...
There's a picture that he took of when a bunch of them came in sitting on the counter, but you have to order them, for now at least, you have to order them on the regular Starfleet store.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Actually, here's a question for you.
Shoot.
Do you actually already have alternate color counters in the clients? Because, like, for example, F&E Civil Wars, it has specific alternate colors for Rebel Lyrans, for Rebel Xintis, as in, like, ones allied with the Winds and during the War of Return,
right,
as well as the Rebel Romulans. Do you already have those colors available in the client, or, like Barry was saying, or...
No.
Would you have to...
No, currently I don't have the ability to select a counter, a alternate counter set, though Lord knows, Les LeBlanc, him, Les, ever since I removed that ability to have alternate counters, has been, well, he did that for many years. He begged me to add him back in. Well, as is, I think that's what I had an issue with. Paramount had a problem with me because of that. That was always the weirdest situation ever, which is I got threatened about I'd be taken to court by Paramount. One problem. They didn't tell me what was the issue. It's like, okay, so tell me, what is it that you found that was objectionable? I don't know what you're talking about. So, whatevs.
You're supposed to just guess.
Yeah, I'm supposed to just know. You know?
Yeah. Should be plainly obvious to the most casual observer.
Crazy. Just to let you know, for those of you who are watching the video, I've actually brought up the SSD book, so you can take a quick look-see at some of the SSDs. You know, like the Romulan freighter convoy, which is interesting. It makes total sense, because mm-hmm. basically they're sublight. Well, I think sublight. Oh, wait a minute. Let me look at this thing, because I think I've got that wrong.
These ones are freighters with warp refit.
Ah, okay. I'm so, it's so close. So close. WRP is so close to WBP. What, from over there, I thought that they were PFs. I thought that was a warp booster pack, not warp itself. Hey, but yeah, you know, 4 liter warp. What's the movement cost of this sucker? Movement cost. There is 1/3. Yeah, that makes sense, because that was early years, right?
Yeah, early years. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I'm falling asleep here.
Okay.
Tell on you guys. Yeah, sorry.
That's okay, Barry. Night. Well, you have a good night and you stay safe.
I will.
Okay, awesome. Okay, see ya. And okay, alternate history, early space dock. That's kind of cool. Oh, she's not this again. Oh, not this again. One of the things that I dreaded, the Romulan Vulture, because they used the same stupid name both for two different ships. I think one was like an early years dreadnought, and one was, I forget what the other one was. but they somebody screwed up and used the same name for both of them, which does wonders for when you try to create, you list them out. It's like, okay, what is it? You know?
I thought but basically in module R7, the War Vulture basically is limited to, I think it's either speed 20 or speed 24. Either way, it's pretty slow. And then the King Vulture is up at the speed 30, so it's like the equivalent of the King Eagle. Mm-hmm. But they're the same baseball, just with better warp engines.
Right.
And so the Vultures that are in this product, they basically kind of like make the progression through the W and Y era.
Right. Actually, so, it says W Vulture. So.
Are you thinking about the Condor, maybe?
No. It was the Vulture. I remember it was the classical Romulan ship, you know, the old type, old style ship that I do remember. But yeah, I don't remember ever hearing of a King Vulture. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe someone screwed up in creating the ship definitions, because I don't remember actually seeing the SSD themselves. I just remember seeing the ship definitions that were created by Aaron Staley.
Well, if I recall correctly, the War Vulture and King Vulture, I think they have the same SSD, but with like shaded out boxes. But I guess for the purposes of the client, they need to be done as two separate third-gen SSDs.
Right, right.
There are two separate ship cards in Fleet Commander as well, though, because Briefing 2 comes with the War Vulture, and I forget which product has the... I think it's one of the later booster packs comes with the King Vulture.
Mm-hmm. That's always weird. Huh? That just makes no sense. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the Romulan W Commando Bird. Now, it has a very small bit of barracks, but it's shown with some cargo. Okay, that makes sense. But then it also has a cargo pallet. Now, I don't remember commando ships having a lot of cargo. Or cargo boxes, anyway. Am I misremembering it? That's normal for a commando ship? That a commando ship has usually a lot of cargo?
Hang on, I'm just having a quick flick through the... W Commando Bird. This ship was given the warp refit along with the W Freight Bird, which it frequently upgraded with, to resupply or place Romulan occupation troops to plant the flag. The Commando Bird was not much of an improvement, so the ground troops were concerned. The accommodations for the troops were always Spartan. On the other hand, the ship had much improved performance for a secondary mission of rotating personnel at distant stations or when combat. So it's less of a ship that you basically send to secure a beachhead. It's more like if you basically already occupy a planet and you want to increase your foothold there, then... Right. I guess that palace would basically come with like supplies, like spare hand phasers or mortars or transporter artillery or tanks or whatever it is that you need. And also, since the ship can land, you can basically bring that stuff directly to the surface. Because, usually a lot of them, they have to stay in orbit. And what they can do is that they can basically use their tractor beam to lower the pod onto the planet's surface.
Mm-hmm.
So... I guess that's kind of where they're going with for this one.
Oh, understood. But yeah, I'm looking at the Commando Bird. It's like, okay, it's just a freight bird, a W freight bird, with replacing four cargo with four barracks. That's basically what it is.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, it's not the most, because it's a fairly workmanlike design. So,
Oh,
But
yes.
also bear in mind the fact that, you know, if you have that, well, actually not for the W1 because it doesn't have a mask, but when you get later in the timeline, you've got a veil or a cloak, then, you know, you can sneak closer to a planet that you're wanting to occupy with it. But you wouldn't, but bear in mind the palette is optional. So if you're invading a planet for the first time, you would leave the palette at home and you would only use the marines that are on board the ship.
Right.
But then once you've secured a foothold and you've pushed the enemy further away from the planet, then you can consider using the palette on subsequent runs to, you know, increase your presence there.
Or in theory, if you really want to do it in that combat situation, I would think you could also bring the palette along with you to the fight, and then leave the palette floating in space, and then so you don't risk it landing, then you land for the troops, and then if you take the planet, great, you can go get the palette. And bring it down. And if you are unable to take the plane, then you could possibly just tow it away, because I'm assuming that there's no force over the planet itself by that time, because usually the idea
The only thing is
of
that I don't think the palette. Sorry.
what's that? You don't think
But
it's a
I don't think that the palette itself has an inherent veil or cloak system. Like you have to be attached to a ship that's cloaked. But the ship has a reduced movement cost when the palette is attached. So,
Right, but
I guess it's one of those things. Like, I mean, like how safely forward would you feel comfortable placing the palette before you go on the attack and not risk someone else coming up and destroying it? But apparently the Klingons do something similar, because I could have sworn that there's a Klingon D5 G, their commando variant, and it's able to actually take a pod as well, because basically the Klingons can like do the same sort of thing where they can either use it without the pod if they're fighting to the beachfront, but once they've secured their holding, they can pick up a pod and bring it back and forth with them.
Well, my understanding of if you bring troops onto the surface where you're actually trying to gather up, usually you don't have that many forces up above the planet. You don't try to take both at the same time. The idea would be that you actually would, defeat any defenders that are above the planet, and then bring in the commando ships to actually land the troops onto the planet, and then take the planet. If obviously that's assuming that you actually wanted to take the planet versus just completely nuke it from orbit, as they say.
Well, there's also the issue of doing like commando raids and stuff. Like you're, you know, fighting to like reach a certain objective and stuff. And you don't necessarily have to, you know, take out the entire planet's infrastructure, but you're just doing one piece at a time. So.
Yeah, that's always an interesting. Yeah, because I was thinking about the whole idea of going into orbit around the planet cloaked, decloak, drop the forces, and then recloak. But for kind of as a kind of a raid kind of thing. But invariably, I would think that would be a very rare scenario, because of in that scenario you'd have to have a blind the planet would have to have a blind spot. Otherwise, as soon as you decloak, boom, all the sensors go off and go whoop whoop whoop. Romulan, 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 versus more of a stealth approach, i.e. a shuttle, an actual a normal just commercial shuttle flying in and landing on the planet, and instead of actually having troops, that kind of thing. I'm seeing if there's anything, any ships that are really of interest to me. Of course, the Falcon. Well, that looks interesting. Which is the Remnant Early King Eagle Command Cruiser. Because I like the King Eagle Command Cruiser. That's one of my favorite Romulan ships. When it's early years, so it doesn't have that much warp.
The early King Eagle, the one that's listed as a EKE, that's a middle year ship.
Right. And in this case, yeah, this is the early year, so it doesn't have the additional plasma Fs. And I forget. I can't remember if. No, okay, no, that was just the plasma. There was just plasma Fs on the warp nacelles, and then, of course, more warp. I think that was the big thing, of course.
Yeah, the regular King Eagle. Actually, if you scroll a few pages over, you'll see the Queen Eagle. The Queen War Eagle, rather. That's kind of closer to what the traditional King Eagle is. But as I say, it's like more of a line cruiser rather than a command cruiser.
Okay, I'm looking for it. Queen War Eagle? Yeah, that looks closer to it.
Page.
Yeah, because I was looking at the first Queen Eagle, and that actually is a carrier. Cool. That's one thing that always gets me confused, because of the King Eagle is also used in tournament play, and I know that the tournament cruiser is modified slightly, which I think, if I recall correctly, it has more armor in tournament play. So that gets me confused when I look at the normal ship versus the tournament ship. Okay, of course. Oh, yeah, I forgot. This is alternate history. Remember that. Because I'm seeing the PF tender and going, wait a minute. It's an earlier ship. Why would it have a PF tender? There's no PFs. But this is...
I could still use the same Centurions or, I guess, Starhawks that you'd see in the standard timeline.
Right. But I'm assuming that the Romulan the Queen Eagle PF tender is only in the alternate history. Correct?
Yeah, I mean, like, I suppose there'd be players who'd want to have it in the standard timeline, but the rule book basically kind of like has it that a lot of that those resources were being used either to work on the Kestrels or build the Hawk series ships.
Mm-hmm.
So these Romans and the various timelines that they offer,
right?
I guess they have more time, mm-hmm. energy to, or more of an illness as well, because they've got bigger fleets that already had some form of warp.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it. I just remember the one from the normal history, let's put it that way, it's called a Chicken Hawk, and it only has the mech links for three PFs instead of the six. So it can't house a whole PF flotilla.
The Chicken Hawk's based on the Battle Hawk, I think, but there actually is a Chicken Hawk B a couple of pages over.
Oh. Ah, there it is. The light PF tender. Yeah. Which, obviously, it sucks. The biggest issue for a PF tender is that one of the things you'd like to have the PF tender to have is special sensors. so that it can support its PF flotilla in an actual fleet battle. And it doesn't have one. I would think that, you know, if it has only supports half a PF flotilla, then it only have half the special sensors. As strange that might sound. But yeah,
more recently they've introduced the concept of half tenders or early PF tenders for other empires too. The idea being that these are basically kind of like the earliest ships where they didn't really have a good sense of how to actually use PFs properly.
Right.
So they were kind of like experimenting with a few different options to try to figure out what would work. And they eventually got to the point where they realized it wasn't going to work. So, so in a roundabout sense, the Romulans were ahead of their time in terms of getting the chicken hawk before other empires got their, half-size PF tenders.
Right. And then, of course, we have from the standard history, we have the casual PFs, tenders. And I know the Lyrans had some. Basically, the idea of a casual PF tender is just one where you've got the the special tractors. I forget what those things are called. Man, it's been too long.
PF mechlinks.
Mechlinks. Thank you. It's been too long. Dang. But yeah. Which, you know, so they could bring them into a battle, but they really aren't supporting them as a tender where they actually can repair the PFs and have the additional cargo space for those repair parts and that kind of thing. It's more just for bringing them into the battle itself. If I recall correctly, I keep on thinking of the D7C as being a casual PF tender.
Almost any ship from a given empire that uses at PFs can install the mechlink refit after a certain time. But most of the time, they can only just take like one PF at a time. And the type of PF that they can take is pretty limited. Like, for example, a survey cruiser can take a survey PF, but most PF tenders, casual PF tenders, can only take like a standard combat variant.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think a commando ship can take a commando PF to help support its mission.
Okay, we have National Guard and so forth. Let me do one thing, which is look at the rule book real quick. Okay. That's something I'm going to definitely read through, which is the alternate histories that are in the rule book.
Yeah, there's some pretty interesting surprises, but as I say, I think it might be best to give people about a week or two to actually read them so they can form their own opinions.
Like, just the introduction here. I'll read the introductions, kind of really short, and it'll give people a taste. Which is, in the Starfleet universe, the Romulans failed to develop warp power on their own. They had two basic reasons: Romulan great house politics, the houses wouldn't work together and share their progress reports, or rather the list of their failures, and the Gord commando raids on warp technology resource facilities. The Gorns found it relatively easy to bribe members of one of the Roman houses to tell them where another house had its research facilities. History records that the Emperor tried and failed to get the great houses to cooperate. History also records that more than a dozen Gorn commando raids, about half of which totally destroyed the research facility, they attacked, and the rest of which caused significant damage. Of the two factors, the Gorn raids were the most critical. The raids not only destroyed key data and killed key scientists, but also produced a level of paranoia among the houses, who could easily tell that the research labs had been betrayed to the Gorns by another house that made other Imperial efforts to improve the cooperation on exercise futility. And so it then goes Yes.
I was just going to say that an example of one of those Gorn commando raids is actually the cover story from, I think it's on Captain's Log 29 or 30. If you look at the various covers for the Captain's Logs, you'll see one that shows like a Gorn ship kind of like shooting a plasma bolt at a Rodman ship, or maybe the Rodman ship shooting a plasma bolt. Anyway, basically, that story is actually set during one of these commando raids. So you can actually, it goes into like some of the stuff that was happening at the time.
Mm-hmm. So, obviously, my only question, I have to read it to find it. And Lord knows I'm a slow reader, guys. So just to warn you, to find out, I'm assuming that in the alternate histories, so a lot of those Gorn raids were failures. And that's the reason why they developed warp technology. At least one of the alternate histories is that. Obviously, there's other possibilities when it comes to alternate histories about how the Romulans developed warp technology. By themselves, that is.
But that's probably the most obvious one, I suppose. There are other more convoluted ones, but again, we'll avoid them for now. But basically, you're not far, you're not wrong. I mean, one of the scenarios basically goes from that, uses that as the inflection point, basically saying that the raids failed for whatever reason, and then goes from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it sounds like, actually, you really unravel what was just said in the introduction. What it comes down to is really one key factor, that the Romulan houses would not trust each other. And, you know, would not actually work together for the betterment of the Empire versus, you know, the Gorns, you know, versus trying to one up the other house. And, you know, and so it's like, oh, you know, I have to be more powerful than this house. And the only way for me to be more powerful is to reduce this other house. Well, the problem is when you give the Gorns tell the Gorns where the research facility of the other house is, you're hurting yourself. You know, because I understand the whole issue that if you let that go and that house builds up that technology so that they are more powerful than you, that'd be a bad thing. But at the same time, you're it's a self-defeating, you know. It's one of those times you just want to shake and go, don't you realize what you are doing? You know? But anyway.
Well, bear in mind that the Romulans are kind of spoiled because, for most of the time, they're the ones that can basically, you know, like, go into war with other empires. It's like a choice. Like, I mean, the Feds aren't going to attack them, and the Gorns aren't in a hurry to attack them either. And, I mean, the Klingons were going to conquer them, but then once the Thorin showed up, that kind of went away. And they didn't contact the ISC, and they didn't seem to much of a contact with the Paravians either. So for a long, in the standard history at least, they basically kind of figured that they had all the time in the world to, you know, get around to conquering the galaxy. But They just were, it was too easy for them to get caught up in their own problems.
Agreed. Agreed. Well, you don't have to have all the, it's like you don't have all the time in the world, period. If you really think about it, you've got a limited amount of time, because it's like any other thing. It's certain, if you don't work towards the betterment of yourself, your enemies will get better without you. You know, obviously there's the whole idea of the only reason why the Federation and the Gorns and other empires try to improve their ship technology was basically because of they were at war. And so you could actually force the populace to agree on spending the money. Even the most ruthless rulers at some point have to have support of the populace. And given that, you know, seeing some of the benefits of war also helps, but you know, that's going to be about the only way. That's why you always see so much wartime, you know, those things related to war, that technology increased so much dramatically during wartime. You know, that's why the whole idea of the space race, you know, the space race in the early 60s, they developed all these technologies, which then those technologies were used by the general populace. They would be able to use by civilians that didn't, yeah, the civilians weren't going to space, but the technology could be used here on Earth, for the technology that was built for going to the moon, you know. So so if the Romans would have left, because remind me, if did the Romans keep on picking a fight with other people, or did they mainly just focus on?
They attack the Gorns a bunch of times, but they get progressively getting their butts kicked. So, but the main reason why the Gorns didn't actually finish them off is because they felt guilty over what happened to the Praetorians.
Ah. And yeah, I know that the Federation is about to pick a fight with the Romulans either. They had no reason to. They're more than happy just let them be. You know, as long as the Romulans don't invade Federation space, they're more happy just like let them be. Yeah. So that, wow.
Well, there's actually there's a couple of things that have been happening, discussions going on the BBS. We kind of passed by them, I think, about last week or one time before. But there's at least one that's kind of tangential to the discussion that we've just been having. Because, well, on the one hand, there's, I don't know if you got a chance to read any of that M81 discussion that we've talked about before.
No, I haven't.
But there's also one idea that, because it's possible. Okay, sorry. So it's possible that in an alternate timeline, that the Klingons weren't the ones to provide warp technology for the Romulans. But if they weren't, then who would? And if so, what would that look like? So I kind of had the idea that. If you recall, like when we were talking about Module C6, there was that map sheet P where you had the Romulans allied to the Praetorians. So I was actually thinking, would it be interesting if the Praetorians were the ones who basically sold ships, or even allowed the Romulans to build Praetorian ships under license?
Right.
So,
yeah, I remember discussing that, which I thought was kind of an interesting idea, especially since the Romulans, like, you know, obviously have a fascination with birds of prey. you know?
Yeah, so you'd be able to leverage all the Moravian ships that are on Shapeways and any new ones that get added later on.
You know, to me,
and also,
to me, what the more interesting thing, which is kind of a reflection, because I understand that the Federation is supposed to be a reflection of the United States. The United States of America, if you want to get pedantic about it. And that is, have the Federation give the technology to the Romulans for what I'm assuming to fight off the ISC at some point. And then the Romulans use the warp technology against the Federation, which, as I said, would be very, like the Americans give weapons to Iraq, and then Iraq uses those same weapons to fight the Americans, you know. that whole idea, which is, you know. Would be reflective, I would think.
So, one of the handy things about the Moravian SSDs is that all their quantum wave torpedoes are kind of grouped, bunched together on the front of the ship, as I guess you could call them adjacent central line option nodes. So, say, for example, if you had the heavy cruiser, instead of it having four quantum wave torpedoes, you could say that a Romulan export or Romulan license built version could have either two plasma G torpedoes, which would be upgraded to plasma S, or a single plasma R. And bear in mind that those middle year ships that are in module R4J, their cruisers still can't go faster than speed 20. So even if they still have phaser ones and various other things, they can't really leverage what they have properly. But if they did have like a Moravian built ship that could go at speed 30 and then slow down and chuck out a plasma R or 2G or S torps, whatever, and has a better phaser sweep than the Warbird would have, then suddenly they've got more options. And the ship can still land on planets, so they'd be able to coordinate it better with the Eagle ships.
Agreed. It definitely would be reflective of the Eagle ships, because they're built basically the same way. Where their main weapons are basically center lined in the main hull, and then you have normally the warp or engine nacelles, because I know with the sublight, that's where the impulse engines are. They're in the cells. They're small, but they're in the cells nonetheless. So yeah, I think that would definitely be, actually it would work out quite well, I would think, just because of it would just be kind of a step to the left kind of thing, where the ships would be relatively the same when it comes to, could be relatively the same armament, but one could move faster, be more nimble, obviously wouldn't have armor, but still it would overall, for when it comes to a Romulan commander, that ship would, I would think, fly quite a bit like one of the old ships, except for that it was more maneuverable.
Well, to put it another way, when the Romulans got access to Klingon ships, so Klingon ships are more agile than the Eagles, but they can't land on planets. Or at least, if you try to land on a planet, you can't get back up again.
Right.
So
It's called Crash Landing.
The experience of using those ships. But on the, well, probably not the experience personally, but the experience of using ships that on the one hand are meant to be used only in space, but on the other hand, maybe have a more even weapon suite, because there aren't the same design compromises that you have to put into a ship, like, you know, bracing or any kind of stuff to be able to survive a landing and get up again.
Right.
Then you basically see the Romulans kind of taking that and then running it when running with it when the time comes to build a Sparrowhawk, because even the more Mongoose-style Sparrowhawk is still designed to be an open spaceship, not a land and take off again ship.
Right.
Although it could be close to be one. I mean, like it's very swoopy, but especially the fast Sparrowhawk. You should like just see the Mongoose version. It looks so cool. So what I was actually thinking is for the Paravian, like in a timeline where the Paravians, not the Klingons, are the main influence, there's the question about, like, you know, would the Romulans basically give up on doing a third series and just build Paravian ships? Or would they end up back at the Hawks, which is probably not that likely because it would be going further away from the start point.
Right.
Or would they basically build an entirely new generation of ships that aren't Hawks but are equivalent to them, that can land on planets, but do something that the Paravian ships don't that makes it worthwhile. Like maybe they've got a slightly better cloaking cost or something. Or maybe they're modular, the way the Hawks are, but in a different way.
Yeah, I think my guess is this, is that if the Paravians were the warp influencers, the ones who introduced them to warp, and that was the ships that they saw that had warp power, and therefore they would possibly even purchase those ships, some ships from the Paravians, so that they have warp power ships, you know, with them immediately, with just some conversions that would be required to put in their own weapons. My guess is, just like in my mind, the Hawks are reflective of the Klingon design. In other words, you have the nacelles on, you know, the back end of the ship, and it's just the Romulans are more stylized version of the Klingon ships, is the way I see it. So the Paravians weren't like that. The Paravians were always, you know, the wings and so forth. So in my mind, what might happen would be maybe with when they've introduced their own, is that they might still have the wings, but they'd be stub wings is what they'd be. Instead of being below the ship, they'd be like almost a flat, a pretty flat ship instead, where, you know, the nacelles still were on the outside, or actually not in the previous ships, the nacelles aren't on the outside wing, correct? Remind me.
If you still have a picture of the Paravian miniature, the heavy cruiser, it's got its left and right engines are on the far end of the wings, and then the top engine is on the back. So kind of like if the Sparrowhawk, kind of the Mongoose Sparrowhawk, kind of lifted its engines up. Actually, are you on the BBS right now?
Yeah. I don't know.
Did you swing by the Shadow?
Brought up Shapeways, okay.
Oh, yeah, I know. I was forgetting something, because there is a Shapeways thing I wanted to mention. Apparently, Shapeways themselves have introduced a new material that mm-hmm. pre-prints the colors for you. But ADB haven't said anything yet about where they're going to do it, but imagine that, for example, like, say, you know, you have the Prestige series, the 1 to 2500 scale.
Right.
Imagine if you got one of those and it's already pre-done for you. Or for, because, you know, you were talking before about tournament 1 to 7,000 scale miniatures.
Right.
Imagine if you could get those, but you don't have to paint them because they're already, like, look great. Now, this is just speculation. I mean,
right.
Something to back that up. But.
And the always the question for those in my mind, because you're using two different materials, even if it's just kind of the dye, It's still a different material. The question is how well will they form together?
If you're in the shapeways, sorry.
Yeah, I'm in the shapeways.
Okay, so go to it's like request and suggestion for the shapeways store. It should be like the first portion of the shapeways BBS section. You click the very
okay on top this one. The discussion board.
Yes, on the BBS. That's right. Okay.
Sack Shapeways project. Okay, go from Shapeways project where Shapeways store requests and suggestions.
Okay, so you should see about yeah. So there's like a section in there.
Mm-hmm.
If you scroll down a bit, there's actually a link in one of my posts to that new high definition
full color
thing. So you can actually see samples of what Shapeways actually does, and then it tells you in the description on that page what the process that Shapeways do is.
Okay. Using UV curing inkjet process, it's cured layer by layer, and then produce objects that have more than 10 million different colors. Oh, okay. Okay. Now the question I have is how much would these things cost? Because from the sounds of it, it sounds like it might actually take longer to print.
Well, to give an example, we don't know that yet, but to give an example about what the result is like, if you go back up to the top of that page, you should see there's one picture that shows like the inside of like a kind of like a diagram of a house, like with
right,
the walls
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah.
And then if you go to the next page, you'll see like a pirate guy, and there's like a drum that has the Shapeways logo on it and stuff. So that can give you a
yeah.
better sense of what it does when you put it onto paper.
Yeah, I got that showing up right now. It looks really great. Looks fantastic. Applications, figurines, medical models, architectural module, realistic visual prototypes. Obviously, the big issue with this, obviously, is that all of those miniatures would have to be redone. Every single one of them. Every single one that they want to add the colorization to. Because I'm not even sure how the colorization would be defined in the model itself. Is it that the color is actually part of the model, or do you have to say, okay, this section is this color, this section is this color, this section is this color? You know? Actually, that's one thing I do not know.
Well, that's why I was suggesting that they shouldn't basically go full in. I mean, well, first we have to see if it works, but I mean, of the different scales of miniature that exist, there's certain scales that are more suited to being display pieces or rather than being, you know, gaming pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, like about the prestige scale, those are to scale with the various, some of the kits that like AMT do. Like, for example, like there's the 125 scale like kit you can get with like the Enterprise and D7 and Vertebrae mm-hmm. and stuff, whatever. Or we call it the Warbird. The 2500 scale Shapeways miniature had to scale with that, but there's only about like 7 or 8 of those up on the
yeah, Dave.
Store so far. So compared to like the thousands of ones that are in the 3788 or 3125 scale, that would be a more manageable goal. And also, you know, I mean, they're less likely that people are actually going to use these to play games in. I mean, there aren't that many people that would use that big a miniature to actually play even FedCom or Call to Arms. Like, it's really the kind of thing that you just put on the mantelpiece and, you know, look at.
but at the same time...
Possible that maybe, yeah.
Right, but here's the thing. But at the same time, when it comes to pre-painted miniatures, for those people, to me, that's a great... If it's possible, now, obviously, as I said, you could do possibly for the new ones and just say, okay, I'm assuming that they allow them to kind of ignore the colors. Okay, just a single color. In other words, you can say, okay, I want the whole multicolor setup. But if...
It seems to be presented as just an additional method of construction. So if you want to use one of the earlier methods, like smooth binding in plastic or whatever, then I guess they won't stop you. So it's just like it's like an adding another bow to the quiver.
Oh, understood. Understood. But here's what I see. You see that them, they're just going to be mantelpieces. I don't see that at all. What I see is for those people who either don't have the energy, don't have the skill, are just playing off too busy, but they still want those beautiful miniatures when they play the game. This would, if this was possible. Now, obviously, if ADA would do this, I'm assuming they would kind of test market it. Because I think this could, in theory, this could increase, totally blow up the amount of sales done of Shapeways miniatures. It really could. Now, obviously, it's one of those things that would have to be tested. We have to create maybe five of them, or possibly just redo the tournament ones, and then see how many people actually are going to buy those miniatures. Basically some limit to set to start off with, and see if people start buying them. And if the people start buying them, then obviously it's going to encourage to convert, either to have all future products using that model, that kind of model which defines the multiple colors, or possibly go back and update the models that currently are there. Because I would think it would be possible that, I'm not sure. Obviously, each one of those colors would have to be defined probably as a different object, so that you get the color right. I'm not exactly sure what's the requirement of those modules. Yeah. Well, Iggy in the chat room is saying that he doesn't enjoy painting at all. So.
Well, one of the things that they were saying is I think Will McCammon was saying in the discussion thread is that whatever the color scheme is has to be presented at the same time as the miniature. So you wouldn't be able to do a custom one afterwards. So right. In some empires, that wouldn't be a big deal. But for the others, say, for example, if you look at the Shapeways storefront now, one of the 2500 scale miniatures that they have is a Lyran heavy cruiser. But there are 20 Lyran counties and the LDR and the fire squadron and all these other kind of unique things. So you're kind of thinking, well, which one do you do? If you can only do one and you can't do 30 of them, who gets to be the face? Do you just pick the home world county because that's where the emperor is? Is that basically the default Lyran color scheme? And similarly some of the other ones aren't that bad. ISC ones, historically, they just use one type of color. But then if you look at, say, the Federation, you've basically got one of two choices. Do you do a color scheme with no decal, with no NCC registry, and then buy the decals yourself? But then that kind of takes away from the point of what you're doing. Or do you pick one ship in the entire fleet? Well, you probably can't pick the Enterprise, because I don't think Paramount will like that. But if you pick, say, the Constitution, NCC 1700, and that is the ship that you get for the colored version of that ship, then is that enough? Or, what is the best answer for that?
No, that would not be enough. You'd want all of the ships at that point. But it depends. As I said, first you have to make sure there's a market out there. And when it comes to the coloration, the different coloration when it comes to the Lyran and the for each of the different counties, the question in my mind would be is how many people would actually buy Separate miniature for each county, for each glaring county. I don't see. I really don't see. I don't know there's that many people that interested in having separate colors for each glaring county and have a separate, basically a separate fleet for each county, which has their own colors. I don't think that many people are really interested
in that. At the very least, you need one for LDR.
That's different because that's the LDR. The LDR is a little different from the regular Lyrans. And yeah, that one I can see. Because you definitely want to delineate between the LDR and the Lyrans. Because how many scenarios in Starfleet battles have you seen a Lyran civil war? I know there's some, but how many? It's rare. It's more of
usually in tandem with the LDR, like a key battle that surrounded the intriguing involving the LDR's like emergence. But actually, here's a thought. So the Lyrans, they have specific squadron in emblems. Like for example, any of the ships that got sent to the Federation front during the General War, they were referred to as the Fire Squadron. So they have an actual specific Fire Squadron emblem that's separate from any of the county emblems. And they have a specific, it's like gray on the top of the ship and then red trim and then red on the bottom. So if you see, like there's a couple of the art pieces that they have for the Infed Commander where they actually show the Lyran as a Fire Squadron ship. And since that's the one that the Federation would know, maybe that would be an option, you know, because basically it's like a pattern that's kind of like common to the different counties, but they're fighting the Feds. So like from a Federation perspective, that's the one that you'd see the most often.
Mm-hmm. Understood. But you know, if we had the fine color scheme for each one and had them painted up according to that color scheme, I think people for the most part would be happy with that. Now, as I said, first things first, we don't get the cart before the horse. In that first, you have to put it out there. You know, if Steve Cole is interested, I'm hoping he's at least open to the idea of creating some that can be take advantage of this process. And if there's enough people who are interested to go forward because of he likes to make money just like anyone else. And Shapeways would love to sell more miniatures. So as it's been put out by chat room on Twitch, for those people who are want to join us, hey, join us on Twitch on twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. And Iggy points out that he barely clips his counters. Chris points out that my artistic skills are at the can't stay in the lines of a coloring book level. And definitely, Dave seems that he enjoys painting the miniatures. His whole Andromeda fleet done in black looks really cool, and I think that probably is very cool. I'm assuming that it's black with some with some of the ridges and so forth highlighted in a different color, which would really make it stand out and really cool. Of course, Chris also says he doesn't play with minis, but if they were sold as pre-painted ones, then he would certainly buy his favorite ships for display. So, which goes to your thing, which you're saying is that the most that you think that these would be great display models. And I think that could also be true. In which case, if they're display models, they'd have to be much larger in that case. Because I would think that they'd want them to be, you know, possibly like 4 inches long or something where you can actually see the details. of the ship. It's got large to that point, if you want it to be a display ship. Of course.
If you go on to Shapeways now and look for the prestige scale, because if you look up, say, the Federation Heavy Cruiser, it'll tell you how long it is. I want to say it's like maybe 4.5 inches. I bring them up in metrics, although I guess I kind of flip back and forth in my brain. That's what happens when you grow up in a country that's next door to a bigger country that doesn't use metric. And then move to a country that's supposed to use metric, but is also next door to a country that doesn't use metric. So that's one thing that... But what I was going to say is... Because they actually showed this in Captain Talk 54. Like, they showed a sample page, and it basically shows the Federation CA and all four of the main sizes. So the 7000 scale, the 788 scale, the 3125 scale, and the 2500 scale beside each other, so we can get a sense of how much bigger one is to the other. But you've actually got me thinking about an idea. What if maybe the best way to test it would be do the same, like, say, you know, the usual suspects, not the movie, but the Klingon D7 and the Federation CA, and maybe like a Romulan KR or something.
Right.
Do all three in 7000, 3125, 3788, and 7000. In fact, actually, because I should note that the tournament 7000 scale one actually comes with all three ships anyway. So there's a CA, D7, and the KR. So that would basically be a way to kind of... But then on the other hand, the only thing I'm thinking is that... I mean, yes, they are iconic ships, but they don't really give you a sense of just what this new format can do. Because, like say, for example, like if you had a Paravian heavy cruiser, you could really go crazy in terms of, like, painting up the patterns and stuff and, you know, making it really pop or something like that. So it would be a much more dramatic ship. But then fewer people would know what it is. So that's one reason why I'm thinking that there should be a timeline where the Romulans use it, because then you can tell people, oh, it's a Romulan ship. It's just, it's a different type of Romulan ship compared to the Klingon type ones that you might have seen.
Right.
So now it might not be fair to the Bravians, but it's, you know, it's reasonable to imagine that it would happen, in my mind anyway. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I guess neither minds are, I'm sure, thinking about this sort of thing, but it's fun to speculate about.
Oh, I agree. Come on, there it is. Sorry, I was on the elite page, and then I saw the Maseron battleship. I was like, ooh, that looks kind of cool. I like that. That's neat. There's the bottom, and okay, stop playing. But anyway, yeah, I think that actually be that, you know, the idea of a pre-painted ship. I think there are definitely people out there, and, you know, maybe that'd be a good way to start, is, you know, create some of the larger miniatures that are pre-painted for as display models, and then see if people buy those. Obviously, like the D7, the Federation Constitution class, the Romulan, you know, at the very least, those three iconic ships, you know, the Romulan, the Warbird / King Eagle / you know, that Hawk series, you know, from the original series, that ship from the original series, and using
The King Eagle does have bigger war engines in miniature terms, so you could do both of separate miniatures if you want to.
Right. But the idea is to make it at least look like, kind of like, the original series, and, you know, what was that episode? Oh, crap.
Palantir.
Yes, thank you. That was it.
Well, actually, you know, because maybe if there's any ADB original ship that could be picked, I guess maybe the Sparrowhawk or Firehawk, like the Mongoose style one, would be a good one, because they are probably the most dramatic in terms of the design. That still belongs to one of the big three. So
Well, as it is, if I recall correctly, what I'm going to point out is that, if I recall correctly, ADB, the whole one of the reasons why they wanted to create the miniatures was for expanding the customer base outside of just SFP people to be more of going into the general Star Trek and sci-fi people. Because obviously, like the Mazerons, anyone who's familiar with Star Trek are going to go, who the heck is the Mazerons? You know, but some people that might play some other, not even play some other game, but like a different universe. I'm going to say Honor Harrington, but that's, I know we don't have any miniatures that even look like that. But that being the idea, that is that you have another universe that has a ship that kind of looks like one of the ships that were used, and then have ADB still sell to them, and even though they're not an SFP player. So that was one reason I was thinking about those for the model is to sell them to the more Star Trek minded people in that case.
Well, I mean, there's a fine line, because on the one hand, ADB should leverage the TV ships that have access to it, but on the other hand, there should be like a way to promote its own designs, especially like the ones that like are the most striking and stuff, whatever. But I mean, it's because I think you wouldn't want necessarily people to think that ADB has been coasting all this time. You know, there's like so many different things that make the Starfleet universe distinct compared to the franchise. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's easy for me to say that since I've usually, spending so much time talking about Omega or the AMC or, that's up getting parading ships to the Romulans, that sort of thing. It's like, for me at least, whatever, I think it's, there should at least be some point at which you're highlighting what makes it what it is and what rather than what it isn't. Like, take Battletech, for example. I mean, a lot of people were kind of upset because they no longer used the designs that were from other universes. But they still managed to come up with things like the clan mix, like the Timberwolf and stuff, that are iconic, but they're iconic for Battletech.
Right.
So, like with the Dark Age, there's a Savage Wolf, which is kind of like a further evolution of the Timberwolf. So in a similar vein, I think there's something to be said for what the universe offers that other universes don't, even other Trek-related ones don't.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay, well, with that, I think we'll wrap it up for this evening. It's already getting late, and I'm sure I'm going to be going to bed around midnight again and get 5 hours of sleep. Okay. Well, Gary, it's been a pleasure having you around, and you have a good night.
And to you. And once again, happy Air 4J Day.
Thank you. So, we had a nice little discussion there about, of course, R4J. Let's get that right. So that you can go and buy yourself, actually, give you a quick look-see at some of the SSDs there. So, I think it's less, obviously, the SSDs aren't, in my mind, that interesting because of they're all the old series, and they're pretty much the same of the old series. But I think the history and some of the rules and that kind of thing, the rules, I think, are going to be a lot more interesting than the SSDs themselves. So definitely it's a product to go out and buy. Whether you want to just get an electronic version or buy the physical product, please feel free. In either case, or as I always say, buy both. At least when it comes to the rules are always, to my mind, you always want the rules in electronic form and the rules in paper form, because me reading the rules in paper, there's just something visceral and different and keeps in my mind a lot better versus having it so that's part of, you know, it's on an electronic device. But, you know, of course, being electronic versions, those are great for searching and finding a certain rule and so forth. And, of course, we had a nice discussion about the possibilities of multicolored counters. Not counters, sorry. There are, yeah, multicolored counters. But multicolored minis, which I think would be a great addition to what ADB already has on Shapeways. Even if, as Chris points out in the Twitch chat room, that if you look up Star Trek on Shapeways, there's tons of them available besides ADB. I still think there'd be a lot of people that'd be interested in what ADB is doing. And possibly, you know, given the reputation of ADB when it comes to the quality that they produce, that they might have a leg up upon compared to some other people. Maybe, maybe not. I'll just have to wait and see. But anyway, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.